Good morning, everyone. I'm not going to ask each of you to introduce yourself at the beginning because I think I know who's who. I've looked at your bios, and if I first misidentify you, just correct me when we begin conversation. A couple of things before I share with you some thoughts about the topic this morning. That topic is this very deeply deteriorated relationship. How did we get here? How did it happen? The first comment is, if you looked at the chapter that I asked you to read in the small book that I did a year ago called Return to Cold War, perhaps you've already begun to construct your own explanation for how all of this has happened. I hope you've done that, and not just a passive reader of that chapter, but actively willing to challenge parts of the explanation or the entirety of the explanation. And I hope you'll keep that in mind as I share with you my thoughts today, some of which will repeat what's in that chapter. I should ask you at the beginning, I know Dmitry Trenin put it on a list of books to read in his last session, including his own recent thing, Should We Fear Russia? But that was, as I looked at the list, that was four or five book-length studies, and I think they're recommended rather than required. So how many of you had looked at that book before this week and before I asked you to read chapter three? Had you looked at, Anna, you said you bought the book, so everybody's been given the book. How many of you have had a chance to take a look at it? How many of you, if you hadn't read it at the time, did go back as my request for today and read chapter three? So how many of you? I'm just looking for what kind of resources we have today. I'm not testing whether or not you met an assignment. Okay. The second thing I'd say to begin before we start the discussion of the topic today is tell you what I would like you to do before Thursday and the last two sessions that are on what might be done about the relationship, the U.S.-Russia relationship. In many ways, it's more broadly Russia and the West, because it's all one large tangle at this point in terms of a very bruised relationship. For Thursday, rather than begin with comments from me, I'm going to begin with comments from you. And what I'd like each of you to do before Thursday is make notes for yourself. You don't have to write a memo, but write notes on the following topic. In realistic terms, where would you like the Russia-U.S. relationship to be 8 years from now? That's quite specific. That's thinking in terms of two presidential terms. Were you to begin outlining a realistic strategic vision that you would share with the Trump administration or on the Russian side with Putin and his colleagues? That's a natural period for the U.S. side. That would be the next election after 2018, and therefore not subject to the way you would think about it if you were only thinking about a Trump administration looking toward the next election. And in the case of Putin, it would be a little more awkward because it would be 2 years beyond 2024 and the next election at that point. But in realistic terms, how would you think about the kind of relationship, when I say realistic, that you can imagine you could achieve if both sides made that their objective? And you can sketch it in whatever way you want, whether you want to make it fairly detailed, whether you want it to be quite detailed in terms of what would be tactically, practically possible, or whether you simply want to sketch something that you think would address key issues that should be addressed perhaps differently, almost certainly differently from the way they are being addressed today. You're not the full 12, you're now 11, right? Because Christy...
Well, there are 12.
There are 12 here? Okay. So what I'm going to do, let's see. I'm going to, in this case, Okay. So what I would like to do is beginning with Joe. Where did I see Joe? So there's Joe. Joe, you look different from this photo. From Joe through Harrison, and the rest of the list. I'm going to have you do this in terms of the way you would advise, the way you would devise a strategic vision for Russia. And for the first portion of you, beginning in this case, beginning with Alex Brown, you do the American side. Then what we'll do on Thursday is I'll pick one of you from each side, and I'll give you 5 minutes to lay it out. Maybe we'll then build on others can take 5 minutes and lay theirs out as well. But each of you should be prepared for that, and then we'll react to those ideas. The reason for that is because when I share with you my own thoughts, and by then you'll have had a chance to look at chapter 4 of my book, but you'll also have read Tom Graham. You'll have for tomorrow looked at the Foreign Affairs piece. You may have read it originally in Foreign Affairs by Steve Kotkin, all of which imply an agenda, if you will, that's quite different from the way Moscow and Washington are today pursuing their agendas. And it'll be in the context of an argument I make in the book and that I've been making for some time, fruitlessly, pointlessly almost, in this political context. And that is, if you were to construct U.S. policy toward Russia or Russian policy toward the United States, the critical difficult planning task is how you integrate the short term, that is meeting the imperatives of current policy. The United States has to deal with Russia in the context of Ukraine, in the context of Syria, in terms of an INF agreement that's under pressure. That has to be an important, even a dominant part of your foreign policy agenda. But how do you integrate that short term with the long run? That is, with the question of where would you like the relationship to be 8 years from now in a practical way? And what kind of intermediate objectives would you set 5 years down the road that would lead you in that, that would lead you in that direction? And that would then, as you back engineer this, would give you some thoughts about the way in which you want to think through what you're doing in Ukraine or in Syria, whether you're in Moscow or whether you're in Washington, that wouldn't screw up the path toward that vision eight years down the road. So essentially what I'm asking you to do to begin the conversation on Thursday is think about where you'd want to get, because in the longer run then, as I say, the process is to go backwards and think about how that would influence whatever your thinking is today. You've had sessions on this with Rojansky and with Wojtylowski on Ukraine. You've done a lot of discussion on Ukraine up to this point, I understand, if I look at your schedule. And I assume with Trennan last week, who was speaking about all of these specific issues, Syria, I think Georgia, things that have happened in the relationship over time, you've been already dealing with that short term. So the question is how you put it in a bigger context when we get to it. Is there any question about what I'm asking you to do? Yeah, please.
What was their groups? What were they? You said half the groups focus on Russia, half the groups focus on the United States?
Yes.
What was it alphabetical?
Well, yeah, I'm sorry. So let me be precise. So in terms of the U.S., doing the U.S., it would be Alex, it would be Merrick, it would be Matt, it would be Emma, and it would be Ian. Where did I see Ian? I saw Ian a moment ago. And all the way through Brenda, then Joe, and Harrison, who I saw over here, and Niall, and Hannah, Melissa. You're Melissa, okay. I confused you with Brenda at the outset, and Taylor, I saw. That group, you will then do the Russian side. Okay.
And I've written this down. I'll send it to you guys in the paper. You're putting that.
And it doesn't mean that what I want all of you to do is wrestle with the problem. It doesn't mean that, in fact, most of you won't actually be asked to deliver. But you'll do a better job of reacting to whoever it is that's asked to speak if you've thought through the problem yourself. That's the reason I'm asking you to do. Okay. The discussion today after yesterday, I assume a number of you, if not most, Hannah, I know you were traveling, were at the lecture yesterday where I talked about U.S.-Russia relations over the very long haul. And the reason for that was because I think if there's one analytically missing element in the way things are unfolding today, it is lack of perspective. Now, it may be extravagant to establish as your perspective 210 years of the relationship, and I'm not sure what insights come from that full 210-year period, because I think most of the insights are based on the last 50 years. The world changed so much after World War II with the Cold War and so on. We're very much a product of that 50-year period. It's not easy to understand the direct implications of 19th century U.S. imperial-Russian relations in that context. We know, however, unless we've been sound asleep for the last 5 years, that the U.S.-Russia relationship is, as I said, deeply deteriorated. It is bad. Most people would agree that it is easily the worst since the Cold War. There are a number of people who have thought about it who say that it's still worse than that, and that you'd have to go back not to the last stages of the Cold War after 1985 and the Gorbachev period, but to find something equivalent to where we are today, you'd have to go back to the first years of the first Reagan administration in the 1980s. I think that's true. I had a fair number of experiences there in the early 1980s and then broadly looking at the relationship, and I see a lot of similarities today, alas, that period, even though Russia is a very different place from what it was in under Andropov in the Soviet Union in that period of time. I don't think in most audiences, however you label this deterioration, I don't think in most audiences there's disagreement that we are in a qualitatively different place in U.S.-Russia relations from where we were 5 years ago or for most of the post-Cold War period. That, I don't think, produces an argument. So then the question is, how do you capture that qualitative difference? Now, what is your conceptual or your analytical framework for understanding how different the relationship is, how bad it is in this context, as I say, qualitatively different from what it was before? And I say that because if you don't have a conceptual understanding of where we are, whether you're on the Russian side or whether in the U.S. side or whether you're a European, because it's broadly a Russia-West issue, not just U.S.-Russia, even though most of what I'll talk about this week is U.S.-Russia. If you don't have a conceptual understanding of where we are, I think you don't really have a basis for understanding how we got here. It's literally the obverse of if you don't know where you're going, any path will take you there. If you don't know where you are, you could have gotten here by any path, if you will. And that's very important from my point of view, because if you don't know where we are, at least you don't have it with conceptual depth, and you don't have an understanding in some systematic, analytically rigorous fashion of how we got here, you're not going to be able to figure out intelligently how we get out of it, how we move forward, as a basis for policy, for thinking about policy. So that's what the stakes are in all of this. There are a variety of ways of conceiving the relationship. One could, for example, think of what's happened in sort of Hegelian fashion. By degree, we have crossed a threshold where quantitative change has become qualitative change. One way to put that is something I've included in the book, and that is for most of the post-Cold War period, after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, I think both sides were not quite sure what the nature of the relationship was. To what degree was the other side a foe, or to what degree was the other side a friend? And through much of that, hoping that it was mostly friend, that's the way in which we dealt with those years. I called it useful ambiguity. for much of the Cold War period. Well, we've crossed a threshold, that quantitative to qualitative threshold, and this is now an adversarial relationship. I think there are very few people anywhere in government, there or here or in the media or elsewhere, that wouldn't argue that, no, this is now an adversarial relationship. And we do describe the other side as an adversary, and we are treating the other side as an adversary. You can see it in the evolution of defense policy on both sides. You can see it in the rhetoric and the way in which we talk about one another and so on. A second way you can think about it is as sort of a part of the species of, in political science, IR literature, enduring rivalry. People have thought about enduring rivalries, those that last over time. The concept originally developed for those enduring rivalries that tended toward war, but that were a permanent condition in international politics. The British-Prussian relationship in the 19th century, in a contemporary period, it's sort of the Arab-Israeli conflict as an enduring rivalry. And if this is thought of as an enduring rivalry, it means that it's not limited to an issue that we're in conflict over, or even a set of issues, and therefore the duration of it is the life of those issues, that issue or those issues. The enduring part of it is it's a hostility that transcends specific issues and is likely to last over the long run. Is that what we've done now in crossing this threshold? Have we entered a period in U.S.-Russia relations that might be described as enduring rivalry? Or what you've seen lately among academics is the notion of either the recrudescence of great power rivalry or the recognition that great power rivalry never disappeared. I'm thinking of John Mersheimer and Geopolitics 101, or depending on which institution you come from, if you're from Harvard as and the Kennedy School, it would be Steve Walt, how Walt thinks about the world, or it would be Barry Posen. I think no one here is from MIT. So a number of very prominent IR specialists are essentially saying what's happened now is that there are some that would say a recrudescence or a restoration of great power rivalry, but most of those would say, well, you know, it was an illusion that it ever went away. It's simply now more prominent in the present circumstances. I prefer, as a concept for understanding where we are, Cold War. I alluded to it in part yesterday, not because I have an intellectual stake in Cold War. In fact, that's not the way I first thought about it. When things began to go south in 2014 after Maidan, and then the beginning of the civil war with the separatists' actions in April, I wasn't yet thinking in terms, not in February, I wasn't thinking in terms of Cold War. But Dmitry Trenin, who was with you last week, wrote a piece called Welcome to Cold War II about that period of time. I said, yeah, Dmitry's right. That is what we're likely moving into. Dmitry, within the year, would take it all back and say, no, it's not Cold War. That's the wrong way to think about it. And he has a different approach that I'll come back to in a moment. I thought it was right because, as I said, my stake is not in the concept as such. It's not as though I want to privilege one particular way of thinking about this deteriorated relationship. But what I want is a concept, what I'm looking for, I think what you should be looking for, is a concept that most precisely captures what the deterioration is, where it is, and one that does it by capturing the complexity of it, all of its parts, but above all else that conveys the depth of the hole that we're in. That is, that conveys accurately just how serious the deterioration is in its many different, with its many different implications. And of all the things that you can think of, that I've just laid out, you know, quantity and equality, that it's now an adversarial relationship. Okay, yeah, it's an adversarial relationship. That's not very distinguishing in international politics. There are lots of adversarial relationships. That it's an enduring rivalry, well, yes, But is that, does that really tell us, in comparison to those that lasted 50 and 100 years, what the nature of this is? And if you simply think in terms of great power, competition, and rivalry, and conflict, again, I don't think it provides the precision I'm talking about that captures the complexity. The principal objective I had in doing that book that you've been given and that I've asked you to read parts of was to offer a standard for judging how deep, how likely durable, how potentially dangerous, and how costly the deterioration is. All of those elements, I was looking for a concept that would give us insight into those four things: how deep, how durable, how dangerous, how potentially costly, not just to Russian foreign policy or to U.S. foreign policy, but to the international setting this confrontation may be. The experience I've had with this book, because I normally the stuff that I've done in the past have been more academic. This is not meant to be an academic book. This is meant to start an argument by confronting people with the way in which, as I've just been laying it out, I'm thinking about what's happened in the relationship. The interesting thing, and as a result, in doing that kind of a book, I've spent a fair amount of time meeting with audiences in Europe, in Russia, and in the United States, mostly in think tanks, relatively few within the universities, but in think tanks and with governments in Europe and in the United States and so on. Much of that was done when the book first appeared, and then with various groups since then. And in almost all instances, what most often happens is simply engagement on the use of the term of Cold War to describe the present situation. Ends up being an argument, a lot of pushback on why it's not the Cold War. When I should say, parenthetically, to interrupt myself, when the publisher was going back and forth with me over a title for this thing, they first said, "Return to the Cold War." And I said, no. I said, that fundamentally misunderstood. You've got to take the article out. This is not a return to the original Cold War. It's fundamentally different from the original Cold War. So that's why the title of this book is Return to Cold War, not the Cold War. That is, to the phenomena of Cold War. But in any case, the experience that I had was basically people only wanted to argue about the label, about the terminology, whereas my primary stake in it are the implications, what the significance is. And one of the things that concerned me in 2014, 2015, and still does, is that the primary focus is essentially on the challenge the other side represents in the context of this deteriorated relationship. The United States worrying about what kind of a problem Russia is today for U.S. policy, the United States, the Russians worrying about what kind of a problem the U.S. is as they define it. And what was missing was any sense of the implications of where the relationship was, what that would likely mean both for their, as I said, individual foreign policies, for U.S. foreign policy in general, for Russian foreign policy in general, but for the international setting more broadly. In short, it has literally buried, and not for the first time, the issue that we'll be talking about tomorrow, which is the great, from my point of view, the great missing issue these days, and that is the stakes. What are the stakes in the U.S.-Russia relationship? Why does the U.S.-Russia relationship matter? By and large, one of the reasons why we've been able to live with, tolerate, even accept this deterioration is because we have, first of all, not focused on the stakes, but the extent to which they're there in the back of our mind, they're lesser. They're small. They're virtually insignificant. It is at a session that Anna was at with me in Moscow for comments that I made there. I called it acceptable wreckage. And essentially, because we don't focus on the stakes, because we don't think about the implications, because we don't have a concept for thinking about the nature of the deterioration, we end up with acceptable wreckage. It's affordable where the relationship is right now. There are people who talk about some of the potential dangers, and they're real. We see that in the newspapers. We see that in government statements. They come from potential military incidents and conflicts, the way in which the Russians, but the Russians are not alone, the way in which they are doing reconnaissance over flights and some of the sea missions within the Baltic and the North Sea. In Syria, we've dealt with it with a deconfliction agreement in that context where we have two air forces that are fighting or operating within the same country for the first time, since World War II. So that preoccupation, which is the most that comes out of thinking about the challenge the other side poses and not thinking about the implications of where the relationship it is, that's real. That's fine. But in the meantime, as I say, you foreclosed the other things. In terms of the debate over the book, I've given you a link to a roundtable that was published a couple of months ago in what's called H. Duplo, which is very interesting for those of you that don't know it. It's a very interesting forum for those that are in security studies. It's not U.S.-Russia alone. But my colleague at Columbia, Bob Jervis, and Frank Gavin, who was a fine historian at MIT, who now runs the new I think it's the Henry Kissinger Center at SAIS in Washington, organized a roundtable to react to return to Cold War. And they asked Angela Stent and Rajan Menon and Jim Goldgeier, for a couple of you are from one of you. Who is from George Washington? You're Alex, you are. So you know Jim. And Condoleezza Rice to react to the book, and then gave me a chance to respond to what they said. So if you want to see that debate, that discussion, I've given you the link on the information that you have for the reading. Essentially, what I've just described is another way of thinking about the problem today. It's what I would call the absence of introspection. Neither side is thinking terribly much about its own role in the deterioration. As I said, the focus is on the challenge driven by the nature of the behavior of the other side, the way we see it, U.S. definition on the Russian side. And that's, as I said, a function of not thinking about the state of the relationship itself. An exception to that is Trennan. And I referred to this a moment ago. He first said, welcome to Cold War II, and then he retreated. And he argued, in the end, there was a version of great power conflict, but he said, in some ways, it's worse than the original Cold War. He gave three reasons why he thought it was worse than the original Cold War. First, he said, there's an absolute lack of mutual respect between the sides. That had begun to change in the original Cold War by the time we were engaged, say by 1967, 69, maybe with Kosygin's visit in 67 to Glassboro with Lyndon Johnson and the like, maybe even sooner than that, maybe with Kennedy's American University speech in 1963, and maybe always. Maybe there was even a kind of grudging respect in Stalin's day. I don't know how you want to see it. But these days, as Trennan points out, there's an absolute lack of mutual respect. Secondly, he said that there is a weakening of whatever rules, informal or formal, that grew up, whether they're the formal rules that were in arms control agreements. New START is being observed, but other agreements are essentially being dismantled. The ABM agreement is long gone. The CFE adapted agreement is suspended. The INF agreement is under pressure. The non-Lugar program for securing nuclear materials, the Russian side has abandoned its part in it. And even the informal rules that we began to develop for third world interaction when there was violence in those areas, those are it's not quite clear where they are. What are the rules today in Syria? What are the rules today in that tension-filled area in Eastern Central Europe between East and West at this point? So a weakening of the rules. And then finally, an absence of strategic vision. No strategic vision on either side. By the way, this assignment that I've asked you to prepare for Thursday is beginning to develop strategic vision, how you would begin, but in practical ways, not Zlot Fantasy, not pie in the sky, but something that 8 years from now, whether on the American side or the Russian side, makes sense, would be that's conceivable, that's doable along the way. Now, the second basic issue or topic that I wanted to raise this morning is how the Cold War concept, the notion of Cold War, serves the stakes that I have. And the stakes, as I said, were to develop a concept in understanding where we are so that we could begin understanding how we got here that would identify how deep, how durable, how dangerous, how potentially costly things are. How does the Cold War help us with that? As I said yesterday, you can think about the original Cold War in its characteristics at two different levels. We tend to think about it, and in discounting the use of the concept in the present circumstance, only in that first and gradual and granted dominant fashion. That is, that the Cold War engulfed the entire international system, that encompassed the international system. This adversarial relationship, Cold War, does not. This is a conflict between Russia and a set of states, basically Euro-Atlantic, with some extension into Asia through Japan, Australia, but doesn't include China. It doesn't include the vast majority of members of the United Nations. So in that respect, yes, it's fundamentally different. Secondly, in terms of a basic ideological animus, that's not there in the way in which it was, at least at the outset of the Russia-U.S. relationship, probably more during the interwar period than after World War II, but certainly during the Stalin period, while Stalin was alive, and even after that. As I said, though I believe the ideological component of the original Cold War evolved, I said yesterday, by the end it was more a prism through which people were interpreting the other side and what was happening in international politics than it was a lodestar that was guiding behavior and what they were doing. Even in the 1970s when the Soviet Union was intervening in Angola or in the Horn of Africa or otherwise, I mean, that had a slight ideological impulse. It very much annoyed policymakers during that period of time. I interrupt myself to tell you a story on that score, how it worked. In both ideology and what they were doing and the extent to which ideology meant different things to different people on the Soviet side. In the 90s, I chaired a number of projects that were oral history projects on the original Cold War. The last one was on the Gorbachev period, but the one before that was on the Carter period and the failure of détente, the 1970s. Détente. And it was what these projects did was draw together the principles from that period of time. On the U.S. side, you could still have Cy Vance and Stan Turner and Harold Brown. Carter was explicitly left out because that would have skewed the way the conversation went. On the Soviet side, the senior people, the foreign ministers, the defense ministers were all dead. So it was basically Kornienko, who had been a deputy foreign minister during that period of time, Stara-Dubov, who had been a senior guy in the Central Committee on this issue, and so on, including Dobrynin, the long-serving ambassador. And in the context of what I just said about Soviet intervention in Angola, Horn of Africa, and the extent to which it had a kind of ideological impulse, that is, aiding national liberation revolution in the context of anti-imperialism and the rest of it, as a kind of mission of Russian foreign policy, not merely a self-regarding tactical or strategic move on their part, it was clear that Dobrynin was absolutely incensed, angered by the way in which what Russia did in Angola and the Horn of Africa got in the way of his agenda for U.S.-Russia relations and arms control and the rest of it. So when this session started, it began with March 1977, when Vance went to Moscow in order to try to move forward on, at that point, the SALT negotiations, the next round of it. And Brezhnev cold-cocked him, just literally shut him out. Vance would say in this meeting, I felt as though I was hit across the face with a wet wash rag. or washcloth. And Abrinan, each time the U.S. side would raise what was happening in the Horn of Africa or in Angola, particularly the Horn of Africa, Abrinan would get more and more incensed. And at one point he would say, no, just stop this goddamn horn stuff. So one of the organizers, Janet Blight, for it went out and bought one of these bicycle horns that you put on, you squeeze, and brought it in and gave it to Abrinan. So every time somebody wanted to talk about the impact of the horn on U.S.-Russia relations, U.S.-Soviet relations, Abrinan could simply squeeze his horn. Well, in any event, people recognize that ideological animus or impulse in that form is not present today. I argue that maybe some of what's happening now in terms of what might be called clash of civilization and Putin's notions that the social values of Russia are fundamentally different from those of the West, Russian Orthodoxy, Christianity, anti-material, the material distortions in the West, the values, the liberal social values, same-sex marriage, and the other things that Russia doesn't embrace, that may be creating a substitute for the ideological impulse. I must say there are Russians that I've talked to. Karaganov did this with me in a conversation 2 years ago in which he said, no, he said, that's significant. He said, since ideology by the end was basically dead letter in Russia, in the Soviet Union, he said, this is still alive. This is vital. He said, this is potentially more significant than where ideology was toward the end of the Soviet period. I'm not sure I agree with that, because all of us can argue about how much of it is instrumental, temporary, how much of it could be turned off and changed tomorrow if media was moved in that direction. And I don't have a firm conclusion on that. Thoughts that it's probably a mix of the two things. And a conversation that I had with Sergei Rubkov, the first deputy foreign minister, private conversation, he made the same point. He said he thought from his point of view that this gap now was as serious as whatever had been the original ideological impulse or a factor. And then, as I said, the third thing, nuclear Armageddon, we had begun to manage it. You know, one of the, again, a parenthetical, but I think a substantial point. We are, again, in the last 2 years, talking about the possibility of nuclear conflict between the sides. That's been unthinkable, unspeakable for most of the post-Cold War period. People of my age and generation after had not really been thinking about the risks of nuclear war between these powers after 1987, 88. For the next 10, 15 years. But in the context of the current confrontation, and not the least because Putin himself has raised the prospect that conflict could escalate to the level of nuclear exchanges, and people in the defense industry and business security are again thinking about what needs to be done in order to deal with that threat, it's there. It doesn't say that we'll get back to it. I was in the news yesterday. There is some state in this country that is beginning to that has just introduced a program by which school children will be taught to do what they should in the case of nuclear attack. I should go back and find that, because I was struck by it. Did you, Hawaii? Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's not as though things have gone away entirely. Indeed, it can't recur in this context. All of that clearly is different today when we think about Cold War. But as I said yesterday, I think there are at least five characteristics that are very much like the original Cold War today. And alas, they are characteristics that were most prevalent, most fully developed in the first years of the original Cold War, the way it was from 1948 to shortly after Stalin's death, as I said yesterday. And I laid them out, so I'll just tag them without going into detail now, because those of you who were there yesterday have already heard it. And they're in the first part of return to Cold War in any event. The first is each side blames the other side almost exclusively for what's happened, how we got to where we are. Again, the lack of introspection, the lack of interest in the interaction that produced where we are today. And not merely because of what the other side did or has done or is doing, but because of the nature of the other side. Again, as I said yesterday, essence of the problem is the essence of the other side. Secondly, as I said, the notion is that the problem is not merely conflict of interest. That's always true in international politics, but conflict of purpose, what motivates the other side, what the other side's all about. And third, that progress can only be transactional here and there. We got an Iran deal. We have a new, in the Trump administration, agreement on southwest Syria for a ceasefire in that area. Maybe we'll be able to build on that. But it's, as I say, limited. It's not because it will automatically lead to, thank you, that it will automatically lead to a cumulative process. In 1972, when we signed the first SALT agreement, when Nixon went to Moscow for that agreement, at the time, Henry Kissinger justified that first SALT agreement as a first step in what would be a cumulative process that would lead to other forms of cooperation. We don't think in those terms today. Nobody would argue in those terms. Maybe Tillerson is beginning to tilt in that direction if he thinks his way through the problem, but no one thinks in those terms at this stage and so on. Those five things. As a result, what I would characterize as the second set of characteristics of the original Cold War, I think apply today, and that's why I would use it. And my answer to the people who say no by focusing on those first qualities that are clearly different, that make it different, I think Condoleezza Rice in her comment on the book in the piece that I said and I responded to it, I think essentially she argued that the differences between then and now are so great that even if you find some similarities, they're overwhelmed or they're overridden by the first set. Maybe that's your position. Maybe you argue, okay, even if there are these other five things that you said, the others are so fundamental that it literally disqualifies the notion of Cold War. My response to that is several-fold, but the specific one today before we now take a break. No, we don't have to take a break yet. We're 9:45, so I'll go for another 5 minutes or so. My response to that is, analytically, what's useful to you in getting at what I said at the outset, how deep, how durable, how dangerous, and how potentially costly, is to focus on the similarities rather than the dissimilarities, if that's where the payoff is. That would be my only counter for this in arguing Cold War. And in terms of the issue of precision, at getting at the complexities, not just the depth, but the complexities of where we are, Cold War for me works better than any of the other alternatives. Enduring rivalry, adversarial relationship, return of great power conflict, that doesn't tell me very much in terms of, you know, that's been so frequent, so non-distinguishing in international politics that, again, my stake is in Cold War. So the key issue after the break, and then I'll let you start interrupting me for points that you want to make and counter so that we have something of a discussion. The key issue is, how did we get from there to here? How did we get from where we were when the Soviet Union came apart in early 1991 on Yeltsin's first two visits in that year, 1992, to where we are today? In the chapter that you read, I begin that chapter by citing Yeltsin's comments on that first visit and Bush Sr.'s response. Yeltsin said I quote now from what I have in the manuscript, "I'm just tremendously impressed by his wisdom." He's talking to Bush. "I think he has incredible qualities, not only as a political person, but also as a person, as a really great political figure of the United States." This is Yeltsin speaking to the U.S. president. Bush said, "I have very warm feeling in my heart about what he's done and is trying to do, and I consider him my friend." That's February 1992, and these two would then sign that agreement in which they said, "We're no longer enemies. We'll work together. We'll even create this democratic peace zone across the northern portion of the globe." If you think about what American presidents, particularly the most recent president, President Obama, and what Putin have been saying about one another for the last 2 or 3 years, even all the way back to February 2007 at the Munich Security Conference, it's 180 degree difference. So as I say in that manuscript, what the hell happened? Well, I don't put it quite that way. What happened? How could we have gotten to where we are? And I, in thinking about it, there certainly have been days when you get up in the morning and you pinch yourself, because if you think back to 1992 and you think now to 2017, doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any sense. Before you start your day job of trying to make sense of it, I was at a meeting in London a couple of years ago, and I had to leave early because I had a speaking commitment in the United States. And as I was leaving, somebody said, "Well, Legbo, you know, where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I have this commitment. What are you going to speak about?" I said, "Well, I'm going to try to discuss the topic we're talking about today, how we got from there to here." And somebody at the table said, "So you're going to go off to explain the inexplicable." And I said, "Yeah, basically that's it." But nonetheless, your job is to get up in sessions like this or in other contexts to explain how we got from where we were to where we are now. There are multiple explanations for it. On the U.S. side, I think the most common explanation is Putin. When he came back to power, things began to go very wrong, even with the first term, but particularly so when he returned in 2012. Then it simply sailed off the tracks entirely. And it's the nature of Putin, the leadership, where he's taking Russia, what he believes in for Russia, what he's done. On the Russian side, the explanation often has been broadly, particularly among the chattering class, that as the U.S. position has begun to erode in international politics, its dominance, its ability to have its way in international politics has weakened, it has taken it out on Russia for some unexplained reason. There is a broader explanation that has figured more recently, and it's one that Putin has used. I don't know whether he really believes it, but he has used it. And his argument is that always, I think he would trace it back to the 18th century, whenever Russia is rising, the West reacts by attempting to push it back, by attempting to diminish it in some fashion. He's made that argument. It has to be made in terms of the West, because the U.S. wouldn't have been the factor in the 19th and the 18th century. So he uses it as Russia and the West. But today, the lead force in that is the United States. Or the Russian explanation may be everything has gone wrong because the U.S. And has forced its allies to attempt to force change in Russia's domestic politics and its regime, that it's determined to dictate the future of Russia as such, not just its foreign policy, but literally the nature of the country. And even an argument, from my point of view, a rather bizarre argument, but it's made by a consequential figure, Patrushev, has said the primary reason why the United States is doing what it's doing is because it wants to control Russia's resources, natural resources. So whatever it is, the Russian explanation, those are explanations for how things went wrong. In the U.S. side, another explanation, and the more immediate one, is what Russia did in Ukraine. That's what sent us over the cliff. That's why we are where we are today. That's why we are what Legbo calls the new Cold War. What Russia did in Ukraine, foreshadowed by what it did in Georgia, has revealed to us that, in fact, Russia is not merely attempting to pursue its own interests. It is prepared to upset or undo the rules that guide world order. that Russia is prepared to literally challenge the nature of or the underpinnings of first European order, that's what Ukraine is all about, and subsequently more broadly, to rewrite the rules of international politics, or at least the guides for its own behavior. For Russia, another explanation would be that it really is where we are today, the ultimate consequence of a U.S. strategy that's been in place at least since the Iraq War regime change, with all of the uncertainties and instability that that introduces and finally now has ended in Ukraine and wouldn't end ultimately unless it also affects regime change within Russia itself. That's a Russian explanation. Maybe any one of those are your explanations. I don't know. That first one on the U.S. side, that it's all Putin, that's very popular. That is the dominant explanation in this country, in the media, and so on. Know one thing about everything that I just listed for you in terms of these explanations, U.S. or Russia explanation for where we are. They're all within a Cold War paradigm. They all fit within the characteristics that I laid out. So at a minimum, the Cold War concept, if you think of it as a paradigm, captures most of the alternative explanations for where we are. A more complete explanation, from my point of view, is that the process that led us here was interactive. We did the dance together. You're entitled to decide who was more responsible for trouble at any one point. To place blame, greater blame at any one time on the other side, I do in the case of going over the cliff, as I blame what Russia did in Crimea and Donbass as a direct and proximate cause for where we are today. I have no problem assigning that blame, but I'm not done there. Most people are done with that. I want to understand how it happened that Russia would do what it would did, what it did in Ukraine in that interactive process. Well, you've been sitting for 50 minutes now, so a 10-minute break, and then we'll carry on. And you can, as I said, start interrupting me. Okay, as I said, I'll continue with points that I want to make, but do feel free now that you've listened to me for this first part, have some sense of where I'm going. And you have problems with it, or you have questions, or you want to make your own point, feel free to interrupt me. Just let me know with your hand. You're welcome to come into the conversation at any point. And I'll try to finish this to give us at least 20 minutes of back and forth. Tomorrow I'll try to leave more time for us to go back and forth. As I said, I believe the kind of explanation that we need for how we got here, what I've been saying up to this point is, where are we? And you hear my answer, new Cold War and justification for that. How did we get here? The explanations that are popular, that are generally around on the U.S. side, it's all Putin. In the case of the Russians, it is the problems the United States are having as its role is diminished or as its role is compromised in international politics and so on. That they're not, for me, they're not satisfactory. In order to understand how we got here, I believe you have to see it as an interactive process. Unless you believe that there is literally a single defining moment, that Ukraine is that defining moment, and all you have to do is explain Ukraine. If you're interested in interactive explanation, you automatically begin extending the time frame, and I would extend it all the way back to the beginning of independent Russia, collapse of the Soviet Union, and U.S.-Russia relations from Bush Sr. onward. That leads to a puzzle, though. I won't try to unravel it or attack it in my own fashion here. I want to save us a little bit of time, but you might think about it, given all of the tools that you now have, and probably the work that you were doing even before, for those of you that are in this area. It's a puzzle. Why did this relationship go through the ups and downs that it has? Why in 2009 in the Obama administration you get a reset? You use that language of reset because at least twice before the relationship has been up and then down. You had those high hopes in the early years under Yeltsin and beginning with Bush and into the Clinton administration. Then you have the effects of NATO enlargement and the down continues down after Kosovo in 1999. Then you have the up again on Bush Jr. When he meets with Putin and looks into his eye and sees his soul, and we begin to make progress. Even after the abrogation of the ABM agreement in 2000, you go to the Rome NATO meeting, and again the relationship is up. You end up with the NATO-Russia Council as a way of dealing with the failed effort before the Permanent Joint Council that goes back to 97 at the time of NATO enlargement. And then it's downhill again through the Iraq War all the way to the Munich Security Speech and then the invasion of Georgia in 2008. And then you get to what I started with, reset. And then we are where we are now. So the puzzle is why? Why did the relationship never acquire any traction that allowed you to go from moments of hope and progress into further hope and progress? Why was it always followed by a deterioration and increased tension? When I look at the relationship over that now nearly quarter of a century, what I see is a kind of sine graph with curves like this, but it's a peculiar sine graph in a way that I don't think we have recognized, and its part leads to the way in which I'd explain the interactive process. If you look at that sine graph like this, it's not on a flat axis. The axis is downward over time, so that up and down, yes, but each time we're headed down toward where we end up. And what's more, if you look at on the sine graph, the amplitude of the curve, the positive side of that curve diminishes in amplitude, and the negative side, each period when you go into a decline in the relationship, it's deeper. So you end up with a sine graph that looks like this over that 25-year period of time, and you have to explain why the sine graph looks the way it is. At least that's one way to attack the problem. Maybe you've got another way of attacking it. Why could this relationship never acquire traction that allowed us to go from strength to strength, rather than it went through the ups and downs that I've just described? At the time, I didn't think in these terms. I wasn't aware, not pushing myself in this fashion. But when I look back on it now, I would argue that essentially from the very beginning, in each period, at each stage, there were what I call malignant seeds that were still there in the relationship. They started as smaller malignant seeds. They grew through each stage of the relationship, through the ups and downs. If I were to describe them, basically it would be three. The first of the malignant seeds was the distorted character of Russian reform, lack of political foundation for it from the beginning, and the corruption that was there from the beginning. The second was the U.S.-Russia interaction in the post-Soviet space that was mild but uneasy from the beginning. The U.S.-Russia interaction, and then by extension, NATO, the West, Russia interacting in the post-Soviet space. Initially, it was, if you think about that malignant seed, where was it, if you were looking for it? It was in the tension over Russia's relations with the Baltic and pulling out of the Baltic area. And then quickly following that, Russia's involvement in what would become the protracted conflicts, whether it was Nagorno-Karabakh or whether it was Transnistria and so on. At the time, we didn't make very much of those things. There was some concern about it, but it never figured centrally in the agenda of the Clinton administration in dealing with Yeltsin's Russia. That didn't become an agenda item, either of those things. Well, the Baltic withdrawal, particularly from Estonia, that was a serious issue for the Clinton administration. They did put pressure on it. And the third of the malignant seeds was U.S. policy elsewhere, particularly U.S. unilateralism in the outside world. At the outset, it was principally in the Balkans, in Yugoslavia, and the early things that were happening in the Clinton administration. These were, at this point, what I call malignant seeds. They were small enough so that they didn't really occupy, the attention of the leadership in a serious way. What happens to these seeds, as I say, they grow over time, even though that That sine graph is moving like this, but their primary reason for the amplitudes, the disparate amplitudes and the axis down, so that the friction over what was happening within Russia, what I call a distorted, in some ways a warped reform, with an inadequate political foundation and with the corruption, begins to mutate into concern over repression, particularly after 2003 in the case of Putin in power. It was limited, but it was there under Yeltsin, but again, wasn't an agenda item for the Clinton administration. It would begin emerging, as I said, with Putin after 2003. 2005, Bush Jr., at a meeting with Putin, raised the issue directly in that meeting in Slovakia. Then it keeps going until you get Magnitsky Act and the rest of it. So you see that malignant seed expanding or growing over this period of time. In the case of the second one, the interaction within the post-Soviet space, what began over some uneasiness and friction with Russia's withdrawal from the Baltic states militarily, Estonia in particular, and the conflicts that emerged as frozen or protracted conflicts. That then begins to show up in the next stage as that malignancy grows with Russia's anger over what I call the globalization of NATO, the notion, you know, we were saying you'll accept NATO, you won't be bothered by NATO and what it's doing or even the prospect of enlargement because it's a different NATO. It's not a threat to Russia. It has a mission elsewhere, mission on the outside. Well, the mission on the outside, the Russians didn't like. Including in other parts of the world, Middle East or South Asia or what have you. That was the notion of globalizing NATO. And the Russians began objecting to that still within the Clinton administration. And then, of course, NATO enlargement itself, which I think is a decisive point. But where does this malignant seed begin to end up? It ends up in color revolutions and the Russian reaction to the West's role. I think a distorted, in many cases, we're talking about misperception that feed the malignant seeds, but beginning to some degree with the Rose Revolution, but coming to something of a peak around the Orange Revolution in 2004 in Ukraine. And then that third point of the U.S. role elsewhere, including interventionism and regime change. You go from Kosovo in 99 to Iraq in 2003 to Libya, Syria, and ultimately to Ukraine. And in each of those cases, what you see is that seed is larger. Now, I believe what happened is throughout this whole period, whether you were an analyst on the outside or whether you were a policymaker, there wasn't a recognition of what was happening at this subsurface level. And we were essentially dealing with the uneasy waves that were on the top that we were wrestling with in one fashion or another. We thought the final act in 97 with the Russians, the creation of the Permanent Joint Council and so on, had more or less dealt with the NATO enlargement issue. We had it behind us. But we never had the NATO issue behind us along the way. The Clinton people, and even subsequently, and Condi Rice and the reaction that I referred to in this book review, disagrees with the book on the way I treat the NATO issue. I'm in neither camp. That is, those that have argued that the NATO enlargement was necessary because... And it was a good thing because it put the historic German-Polish problem behind. That was an argument that was made even by people like Carsten Voigt and Christoph Bertram, SPD, not just CDU in Germany, that it was it wasn't directed against Russia. It was very useful in helping to encourage democratic and market reform within these societies. And third, we didn't want to have a security vacuum, a new gray zone in Central Europe and so on. That's one side of the argument. The other side is George Kennan, strange bedfellow Paul Nitze, who said, you know, Russia at some point will be back and you won't like Russia because it's the way in which it comes back because of its objection to NATO enlargement. In the book, I argue that I think, you know, each side, there's merit to both sets of arguments. The problem is they miss the point from my point of view. And the problem in terms of what leadership was not doing was honoring its own commitments, going back to the Treaty of Paris for a New Europe in 1990, and then repeated subsequently at Heads of States meeting of the OSCE down to 2010 in the meeting of the OSCE in Austin in 2010. What was that commitment? That we will create a united Euro-Atlantic security community from Vancouver to Vladivostok, in which we will build that community around a common agenda, common approach. That's not just a fuzzy idea from the ivory tower. That's what national leaders were saying from 1990 through as late as 2010, and never really worked that problem in a serious way. The only way you could have worked that problem is if you solved a different security problem in Europe, the European security problem, not by solving the security problem of the Czech Republic after 2002 and Hungary, or even the Baltic states, but if you solve the Ukrainian security problem, if you created a system by which Ukraine could feel secure, which had only been done if the Russians were part of it and had bought in on it, would you have created a Euro-Atlantic security community from Vancouver to Vladivostok? That was too difficult. That was too difficult a problem. But nonetheless, that was the problem that they should have said we have to solve if they were serious about what they've been saying from 1990 forward, and they didn't. I was, as Anna said yesterday in introducing me, the chair of a commission led by Sam Nunn and Wolfgang Ischinger and Igor Ivanov that began in 2010 and reported ultimately in 2012 at the Munich Security Conference. It was made up by and large by people who had senior positions within government over time from Russia, from Eastern Europe, from Western Europe, one from Canada, several from the United States. Even at that late stage, I thought when we began this, well, we'd end up, their former policymakers, sort of kibitzing on the edge of how you deal with where that relationship was post-Georgian War, and at a time when we were arguing about missile defense in Europe, the phased adaptive approach of the Bush administration, or even what was going on under the Obama administration. That wasn't what they wanted to do. Essentially, what they wanted to do was come back and visit this question of why have we not been able to make progress on a Euro-Atlantic security community that was inclusive in the way in which we said we wanted to do it. And they issued a report on what needed to be done. That's online. You can see it. There was one other part of the story that I think is useful of as an insight into what was not happening. The Euro-Atlantic Security Initiative also created a set of working groups on specific problems, and the one whose time had come was missile defense. At the Lisbon NATO summit, alongside which there was a meeting of the NATO-Russia Council, Medvedev, then president, came to that meeting, there was an agreement that we would cooperate in doing missile defense in Europe, and we would work that out. And they began that process for the next couple of years. So this group was set up. It was chaired by Steve Hadley on the U.S. side, by Volker Ruhe on the German side, and by Vyacheslav Trubnikov on the Soviet side. Hadley had twice before in administrations been responsible for trying to move forward on missile defense. I remember sitting in a parking lot on a telephone trying to persuade Steve to take on this position. He said, no, he said, I've failed, I think he said three times before, I don't want to fail a fourth time. He said, get George Shultz to do it. I said, no, we want you to do it. He was in the Euro-Atlantic Security Commission. Volker Ruhe was one of the moving forces behind NATO enlargement, originally on the German side. Vyacheslav Trubnikov had been ambassador to India, he'd been a deputy foreign minister, he'd been head of military intelligence. So these were experienced people. There were five ex-ministers of defense in this group. There were a series of experts, both inside the commission and on the outside, that knew the issue of missile defense. And over the next 10 months, when this was set up in 2010, they worked out a program for missile defense cooperation that laid out the principles that would have to be honored, the organization that would be necessary for it, and even a map of what it would look like that was done by the Trey Obering, who had been the head of the Missile Defense Agency in two administrations on the U.S. side, and Victor Yesin, the fellow I referred to yesterday, the last chief of staff for the Soviet Strategic Rocket Forces. So again, not a bunch of eggheads, peaceniks from universities that were interested in doing this. They did this all within a relatively short period of time. And that you can read their report of what it should look like. At the same time that this exercise was underway between NATO, the United States, and Russia, that was going no place and in the end essentially failed. Why? The reason was not conceptual, as I've just said. These people, kind they were able to do it, but it was political. And on the U.S. side, Steve Hadley asked not to issue it early because he wanted to work with the Republicans in Congress who were working on a defense appropriation bill. He didn't want to issue this, which would have, from his point of view, have simply been sort of red bait, red meat for Republican opposition that would use it to beat up on the Obama administration. Mark Kirk, the senator from Illinois, and several others had done a letter, which 28 of the Republicans signed and sent to Obama saying, don't do missile defense with the Russians because it'll simply mean technology transfer to Iran. It'll leak out in that fashion. So already you had the political obstacles that was creating impediments in the way, the diplomacy of it, the way in which you negotiated. On the Russian side, Igor Ivanov, who was co-chair, was reporting to Medvedev and to Prokhodka and to Lavrov. I was the one that was in contact with Ushakov, the advisor to Putin, who was then prime minister. And when it was done, Trubnikov, the Russian co-chair, took the report back. Prokhodka, Lavrov, and the others said it would be the Russian way you would respond to something like this. Well, this is professionally done. It's not precisely where our position is diplomatically, but it's professionally done, which meant essentially it's worth considering. And, you know, we'll let people take a look at it. When Trubnikov went to the Ministry of Defense, they said, this is nonsense. This is dangerous. Why are you even engaging in this kind of thing? So the answer to the question of why that kind of thing failed at each step of the way was politics. Politics. It had nothing to do with the conceptual difficulty of reaching some kind of an agreement. So when I say that we failed to honor what we said we wanted to do in the Charter of Paris, or in those meetings of heads of states at the OSCE, wasn't the conceptual problem. It would have been difficult. Would have been very difficult to say the problem we want to solve is Ukrainian security or the lands in between, Belarus, Moldova, Ukraine. But it was a lack of political will in the context of a political environment that was obstructive. That's why I come back to the larger point that I made, what accounts for the lack of political will? And that's the subject that we want to talk about tomorrow. That is a failure to recognize what the stakes were, what the costs were of failing to do it. And I think that's still there with us today. I don't think today we think about the stakes. As I said, affordable wreckage is where we are at this point. Well, as I said, then I will stop. These seeds grew over time in a way that leadership on both sides were not recognizing them, not dealing with them. The question I asked myself, if in, say, the mid-1990s, the Clinton administration and the Yeltsin leadership had recognized what was growing below the malignant seed, would they subsequently have dealt with these things differently? Say NATO enlargement, rather than doing a permanent joint council, which the Russians never liked and the Russians walked away from in the context of Kosovo in 1999, what if they'd thought long and hard about the potential damage that would be done in the relationship by NATO enlargement, rather than assuming you were getting the issue behind you, and at that point created what they did in the spring of 2003, which was the NATO-Russia Council, which the Russians saw permanent joint council as essentially 19 states against one. The way the NATO-Russia Council was set up was that NATO didn't consult and coordinate before they came and met with Russia, but there was supposed to be a deliberation among all parties. It didn't quite work that way, and created a set of working groups that were quite meaningful. What if they'd done that in 1997, 1998? Or subsequently, what if they thought long and hard about what would be necessary to save the adapted CFE agreement that would have required compromises on all sides rather than Russia eventually suspending it in 2007. That would have required compromises by the Baltic states in the context of the adapted CFE agreement in 1999 when they began changing CFE. Or what if in 2008 the United States had fought long and hard in their dispute with Germany and France over whether or not you guaranteed Ukraine and Georgia coming into the United, into the NATO alliance, at which point, since the Germans and the others absolutely refused to make that commitment, that is a map, military action plan that would have been a first step toward Ukraine and Georgia coming into NATO, the compromise, the Germans wouldn't have that. And the Germans were not alone. So what did they then end up doing? They ended up with this broad phrase that says, at some point, Ukraine and Georgia will come in to NATO. It's an open-ended committed, but it'll happen. That was the compromise, without thinking about what was happening at a deeper level. And there are any number of instances along the way where choices were being made to handle the surface trouble without understanding what was going on below. And what was going on below was these expanding, what I call malignant seeds, interactive process. Now, that was true on both sides. That was true on the Russian side, too. The Russian side had, in 2003, in the context of the U.S. going to war in Iraq, after that, they created a strategic dialogue. I describe it in the book, with very high-level people on both sides, the National Security Council on the U.S. side, outside a bureaucratic or interagency process, same thing on the Russian side, to talk about fundamental issues that were now dividing the two sides. How do we get to the root of the problem? Strategic dialogue. They agreed to a one-page set of principles of what would happen. They included things like no subject would be off limits. So we could talk about the interaction in the post-Soviet space that you're neuralgic about, but you have to let us talk about it and raise our issues. The subjects would be raised in advance. They would know what was going to be raised in that context. There would be no sharing of the results of the conversation with third parties publicly or privately. And we wouldn't go public with an issue that over which we were disagreeing until we had actually raised it with the other side. A set of principles for it. It met every month for a period of time, and then failed for a variety of reasons that I won't go into the time. It had to do with the politics of it. But that kind of strategic dialogue was essentially what would have been necessary at that point to go more deeply into what was happening in the relationship, and essentially it never took hold. It failed by the end of the Bush administration, and going into the Clinton administration. There were other minor attempts along these lines. The same thing was true in terms of the final phase, and then I stopped. Obama came into office in 2009, and as you know, Biden goes off to the Munich Security Conference and announced reset. The notion of reset as such, which is a computer term for rebooting, a computer was basically devised by Mike McFaul, and the idea was it wasn't a concept for a new policy. It wasn't the equivalent of containment. It was essentially, how do we stop the downward trend, change the tone of things, and prepare the way for a different kind of relationship, working on it in a different way. They set essentially on the U.S. side four benchmarks for what they wanted to accomplish during the reset. They were quite specific. The first was they needed to get follow-on to a START agreement that was expiring December of 2009. The second benchmark was that they would get the alternative supply route to the war in Afghanistan, the so-called Northern Distribution Network. The third thing was that the Russians would sign on to what would be Obama's first signature foreign policy initiative, an international conference on nuclear security, that is securing fissile material around the world. They wanted Russian buy-in to that idea. And the fourth thing was that the Russians would back efforts to tighten the sanctions on Iran in the United Nations, what ended up being Resolution 1929. With delay and some difficulty, they got all four of those things. And then the question was, where do we go from there? The initial effort was to think about trying to strengthen the economic basis of the relationship, moving away from arms control as bearing the major burden for improving relations. They had gotten New START. You'd had the Prague speech by Obama in April of 2010. And as a result, on both on the European side, on the U.S. side, you got this emphasis on joining the Russians in their own effort during the Medvedev presidency on modernization, economic modernization, even IT. Remember, Medvedev comes to the United States, and he comes out here to Silicon Valley for that visit. And the second summit where they meet in this country after the 2009 summit of Obama in Moscow, was beginning to move in that direction. But what happens? Essentially, what I described earlier is negative synergy begins to set in because these other issues emerge. So now I'm back to the homely story that I shared with you a bit ago about missile defense. Missile defense becomes a negative factor in the relationship. You're not making any progress. You have a series of other issues, including ultimately during that period of time, by 2010, the Magnitsky case and what's decided, and ultimately then that summer in 2013, Edward Snowden. So all of these negative factors begin to accumulate. And as a result, by the fall of 2013, there is supposed to be, there'd been a meeting between Obama and Putin in Dublin at the beginning of the summer where there'd been some progress on cybersecurity, maybe even some hope for progress on missile defense. It didn't materialize in the course of the summer. So that fall on the sidelines of a G20 in Moscow, the two men were supposed to again meet and Obama called it off. It meant that Obama essentially was taking Russia off his desk at that point. And he essentially said, okay, if Bob Gates, Minister, Secretary of Defense, and Hillary Clinton can make progress as Secretary of State, fine, okay, but I've got other things that I've got to attend to. Then Ukraine comes along, and Russia's back on the desk, but very much in this negative way, where Russia now is a problem, is a central problem, it is a security problem. And what you see at that point is the final impact of the malignant seeds that have been growing over all that time. So you cannot understand, from my point of view, you can't understand what's happening between an Obama administration that had invested so much at the outset in those hopes. And I parenthetically, I think the reason for that is that Obama's number one foreign policy agenda, he laid it out in a foreign affairs article when he was a candidate for the presidency, was what? It was nuclear weapons. The only explanation for why Russia becomes so central to Obama in that first administration can't be because of Russia's importance in so many other respects. But if you're going to work the nuclear problem, what is the country that you have a relationship that's in repair? It is Russia. And Obama was the first American president who simply didn't think in Cold War terms. There were any number of cases where the issues were brought to his office. For example, bureaucracy got all worked up when the Russians sent an SSBN off the coast of Latin America. And Obama said, no, we've got other things we need to worry about. We're not going to focus on that, react to that. But by Ukraine, you began to see the effect of what I've been describing, the sine graph along the way. Okay, we've got about 15, 20 minutes. So you're welcome to react however you want to react, whatever thoughts you have, whatever pushback you have.